from 89.3 KPCC. This is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Happy Pledge Wednesday to you. We're going to start today's show with fire, last year's Woolsey fire to be exact. A new report out of LA County details numerous lapses in response that allowed that fire to spread. 1,600 structures were destroyed from Westlake Village to Malibu, totaling billions in damages. Three people were killed. The report was put in motion by Supervisor Sheila Kuhl. Her district includes many of the areas ravaged by the fire. Supervisor Kuhl, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Thanks for being here. Now, there were over 150 findings in this report, which attempts to explain how the Woolsey fire spread so fast. A major finding that stands out is how many requests for more resources went unfulfilled in the first few hours of the fire, and that's because the Camp Hill and Woolsey fires all broke out within 8 hours of each other. Supervisor, walk us through some of the system breakdowns taking place in those first few hours.
Okay, let me say first, though, that the task force that we put together last year through my motion, came up with recommendations not only about what happened in terms of the fire starting and how it spread and the responses, but also evacuation notices, evacuation routes, repopulation notices, like you can come home, whether that worked or not, and when and what, and rebuilding. So it's a big report. But in terms of the fire itself, I think it's important for your listeners to understand there is no fire department in the nation that has sufficient resources to deal with a major fire. So what we have, which is kind of unusual according to other countries in Western Europe and, you know, in Scandinavia, et cetera, is we have mutual aid agreements. So, for instance, the L.A. County Fire Department might have to take the lead because it's in our area. Mm-hmm. We have L.A. City Fire, Santa Monica Fire, Pasadena Fire, and then all the way from Arizona, Northern California, and in almost all of our fires, we get, you know, good response because we're the fire of the moment.
Okay.
And that was not the case with the Woolsey fire because the camp fire was going on. There was another fire in Ventura, and they started earlier, though they all spread within 8 hours of each other.
But in those first few hours, Supervisor, what was going on that led to some of these breakdowns? Because it felt like things were paralyzed.
No, they weren't paralyzed. The difference is we threw everything we had into it. It started in Ventura County, and it spread into the valley portion. You know, that side of the Santa Monica Mountains. We were all in, and Ventura Fire was still putting out their, or trying to contain the fire in their county. Other fire departments had been assigned to other fires, and they were also worried that the fire was going to spread so fast that they needed to stay in their own jurisdictions and not really send their engines. So we were all in. Nothing was paralyzed, but as the fire spread towards the ocean, it spread so fast and through, for the first time in the history of the county, it spread through every fire canyon. Usually it zooms through one, but we contain it by the other.
But weren't resources tough to get at? Isn't that kind of the point, is that resources were tough to get at?
Not really. The resources were on the valley side of the fire fighting the fire. As the fire spread more quickly than we'd ever seen it spread before because of the winds, the resources could not get through the canyons to get to the other side. And if you see the video of the firestorm around the fire trucks trying to get through as it sped past them, you would understand. However, it's true that there were insufficient resources because those who normally provide mutual aid were at other fires. So we, you know, we were coordinating it from the valley side where the fire had started. And, you know, I just think people are under the impression that no matter what, there's plenty of fire trucks. I also want to emphasize that we evacuated 250,000 people. And when you say three people died, I think it's a tragedy, but I want to say only three people died out of 250,000 people who were helped to leave. And when we couldn't get all the fire trucks through to the other side, we had to emphasize saving lives.
So, Super, were emergency responders overwhelmed by the scale of this? I mean,
well, yes, but not in an unusual way, except that the fire itself was a perfect storm of complexities. A wind-driven fire, the biggest we've ever seen, the fastest we've ever seen. And we were, you know, between city and county, pretty much on our own because other trucks couldn't get to us or were already deployed in Northern California or other fires.
Well, you mentioned being on your own. One of the things this report seems to make clear is that in times of serious trouble, like what we saw last year, that agencies might not be able to be there to help and that residents should make their own plans to prepare for fires. And I think this is going to hit the people that live here, Supervisor, pretty hard to hear that they might actually be on their own. Why is this the case?
Okay, it's not on their own for fighting the fire. What we're saying in the report is we are going to call on homeowners groups, individual homeowners, community organizations, and cities to do everything they can to help people prepare better. People did not take seriously enough really removing vegetation from around their house, even if it might be required by law. We are going to be able to tell people how best to harden their homes if they want to have... for instance, all you have to do is put a $3 mesh across your vent so that the embers don't come in. Most of our structures burn from the inside out. Embers get in through the chimney. Embers get in through open windows. Embers get in, and boom, your house is on fire. So we want people to be able to prepare better, and we have to count on them to prepare better. The other thing where we say people are on their own, they're not on their own. They're really working together, and we need a much more concerted plan for how we are going to work together because this fire is going to happen again. And already we're having little fires. But what we've learned already helped us with the Saddle Ridge fire, for instance, much better communications. And that's the other part that really was a problem for us. People think their cell phones are going to work when the towers melt, but they don't.
Supervisor, one last thing while we have you here. The report makes over 80 recommendations based on all the findings. All of these recommendations, they range from technology upgrades to even more studies. How will you decide which one of these recommendations or how many of them to pursue?
I think eventually we'll pursue all of them. What we need to do is figure out what we need to do first. The problem for us really is how many different jurisdictions have to collaborate for communications, for instance, what we need from the federal government and the state government about protecting their parks so the fire doesn't spread through them. But I would say we're going to take every one of them, allocate them to different departments, and work with the state, the feds, and all the cities who are all in now, along with the communications companies, maybe radio stations, so that we have much better real-time information for them to broadcast. Because frankly, in the case of AM especially, that's the place where people might all say, okay, I'll tune my radio for it because I can do that even if I don't have a cell phone.
That's LA County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl. She represents District 3. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you, A. It's really good to talk to you.
All right, switching gears, if you need to get somewhere fast in LA and not drive yourself, Uber and Lyft tend to be the usual go-tos. Taxis, well, not so much anymore. That is about to change, or so the city hopes. Los Angeles Department of Transportation is proposing new rules to the City Council's Transportation Committee this afternoon so that taxis can be more competitive. Take-Two Sue Carpenter met with the LADOT to get all the details. Hello, Sue.
Hey.
All right, so what exactly is LADOT proposing for taxis?
Well, a lot of things that seem overdue, things that are going to make them operate in a way that is a lot more like Uber and Lyft. So right now, there are 9 taxi companies licensed to operate in Los Angeles. And if you're not hailing one on the street, you have to call the company's individual dispatch number. But under the new rules, all of LA's taxis would use a single centralized dispatch system. They could be requested with an app, not just by phone. And passengers would also know the cost of their rides before getting into the car.
So exactly like Uber and Lyft, right?
Yeah, very much like that.
So what does LADOT want to make these changes?
Well, pretty much what you and I have guessed. The business has been obliterated since Uber first came to town. So since 2012, taxis have lost 75% of the market share in Los Angeles. LADOT says they provide a valuable service to people who aren't able to use ride-hail services. They might use a wheelchair. They don't have a cell phone or a credit card. So most Ubers and Lyfts do not have wheelchair access. You need both a smartphone to request a ride and a credit card to pay for it. Taxis, you can still pay cash even under the new system.
So is this a bit of a Hail Mary pass to save the taxi industry?
It seems like
it.
So LA DOT, they acknowledged that some of LA's taxi companies are not likely to survive. It also said they've met with all the city's taxi companies multiple times throughout the process of changing the rules to get their input. Most cab companies like at least some of the ideas that LA DOT is proposing, but they're also a little bit nervous, understandably, because this is an industry that hasn't changed in LA for decades.
What about the way taxis look? Will they look exactly the same once new rules are adopted?
No, I think this is so interesting. So right now, taxis, they're required to have so-called trade dress or certain colors that easily identify them as cabs. But under the new rules, they would only need to have an official decal. And the reason LADOT wanted to relax this trade dress requirement is so companies can, or drivers, they can lease or rent vehicles. It also makes it easier to sell a cab once is no longer used as
a
taxi.
So no more yellow checkered cabs?
Well, we're about to see. Maybe they'll still want to do that to differentiate. We'll see.
But do you think the number of taxis in LA will change at all?
I think it's going to go up. So right now, and this seems shockingly low, there are about 2,600 taxis in all of Los Angeles. LADOT is suggesting there no longer be a cap on the number of taxis in the city, and it's also trying to make it easier to become a taxi cab driver by making the application process digital. DOT says the driver onboarding process will be shortened to 48 hours. Right now, it's entirely done with paper, believe it or not, and it takes about 2 weeks.
So easier to become a driver. That sounds like it's a drawback, not a good thing.
You know, easier from an administrative perspective. Okay. So right now, the process of permitting a taxi driver is all done by hand. So the new system would move online. Drivers would still need to provide a social security number, get a drug test, be fingerprinted, and verify their driver's license. They just wouldn't have to be shuttling the paperwork back and forth from agency to agency.
All right. So let's talk timing. When is all this going to happen?
Before the end of next year. I mean, they're going to be the franchise rules. They expire at the end of this year, and then they're going to start crafting these, kind of coming up with the details. But it should be taking effect before the end of 2020.
So no more hailing a cab with, you know, your finger and your whistle. And, hey, cabbie.
Do you ever see anybody doing that in Los Angeles?
I did that once because I wanted to know what it was like, but that was it. Just once. Take two, Sue Carpenter, telling us about the LADOT's proposal to change the rules for taxis in the city so they can better compete with Uber and Lyft. Sue, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, if you only had a second to define the term homewrecker, you'd be forgiven in the post-Jerry Springer Show era for imagining a betrayed husband or wife sitting next to their cheating spouse when along comes the person who came between them. Now, that isn't the kind of homewrecker we're going to talk about today, but there are a lot of similarities. Fraud, greed, capitalizing on someone else's misfortune, all of that has been used to describe the big tycoons who made a killing foreclosing on mortgages after the 2008 housing market collapsed. And now, yes, the phrase homewreckers has been thrown in there. That story is at the heart of a new book of the same name. The author is Aaron Glantz, a journalist at the investigative news site Reveal. And when we spoke, he explained how one of the biggest culprits of the collapse was right here in our own backyard.
There were a lot of bad mortgages. There was a lot of aggressive salesmanship. And for example, in Southern California, you had this bank, IndyMac, just right up the road from KPCC in Pasadena, which became famous for loans called ninja loans, which meant no income, no job, no assets, no problem. anyone could get one of these loans. There were interest-only loans where the amount you owed actually went up instead of down every month. But then when home values started to slip, all of those loans went bad and IndyMac went bust. And so what I wanted to do in Home Wreckers is pick up the story after that and find out, well, who made money when 8 million Americans lost their homes in the housing bust?
Now, you break down a lot of the players in the book in two categories, victims and villains. We're going to get to the more well-known villains list later. But as far as victims go, you focused a lot on Southern California. One of those victims, Sandra Jolly. Tell us how she went from victim to, in some ways, a survivor in this.
What made her story so incredible is that here was this woman, just an ordinary Southern California homeowner whose parents had bought their house back in the 1980s for less than $90,000. And then, now we're getting into those bubble years when they got old, they saw an ad on TV for this reverse mortgage that sapped their wealth.
What are reverse mortgages?
With a regular mortgage, the bank gives you money and you pay it back month after month and you own more and more of your house. Mm. With a reverse mortgage, the bank gives you some money and you never have to pay it back, but every month there's more interest and fees, and the loan gets bigger and bigger until when you die, the bank takes the house. And that's the kind of loan that Sandy Jolly's parents got. A salesman came to their door and he said, "What's the catch?" There is no catch. And that's why when they died, Steve Mnuchin's bank, this bank IndyMac.
And he's the current Treasury Secretary,
He foreclosed on Sandy's family.
Yeah, and so that's where the villains, many of the villains, as you label them, come in. You mentioned Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and they, along with others, are all part of President Trump's inner circles. How did they wind up being the winners post-2008?
So what Steve Mnuchin did, I was talking earlier about IndyMac. When it failed, the government ended up owning it. And what the government did was it sold it to a group founded by Steve Mnuchin, who back then was this New York former Goldman guy. And they said, "We'll buy this bank off of you. We'll pay you $0. And the government was so thrilled to get this off their hands that not only did they sell it to this group for nothing, they also agreed, the FDIC did, to subsidize their foreclosures. And documents that I got under the Freedom of Information Act showed that Steve Mnuchin's group was paid more than $1 billion by the government as it foreclosed on more than 100,000 families, including 23,000 seniors like Sandy Jolly's parents. And Wilbur Ross is in the book because he did basically the same thing with this Florida bank called Bank United.
So what are they doing now to ensure that they keep winning?
Well, these guys and some other associates of Donald Trump, like Steve Schwarzman and Tom Barrack, Donald Trump's closest friend who introduced Ivanka at the Republican convention and planned Donald Trump's inauguration, Steve Schwarzman, the chairman of Blackstone. Together, these two guys founded companies that bought homes after they were foreclosed on by banks run by people like Steve Mnuchin and Wilbur Ross. And it's these two types of businessmen working together that resulted in, as you mentioned, the home ownership rate bottoming out at its lowest level in 50 years.
How has this all played out for renters and landlords?
Well, this is just increasing the mercy that we are at when it comes to landlords. And as more and more people become tenants, we're spending more and more of our money increasing landlords' wealth instead of putting it in our own mortgage payment and accumulating wealth that we can have for our children or our grandchildren or to cover a medical expense or retire. So in L.A. County, the home ownership rate is now 45%. That's lower than New York. It's the lowest amongst any major city. And that is partially because this new breed of Wall Street landlords, whose founders are close to the president, they are jacking up rent incredibly fast.
Talking to Aaron Glantz about his new book, Home Wreckers. Aaron, why didn't the Obama administration do more to help people instead of bailing out banks?
The story that I tell begins in 2008, ends in 2017, and for most of that time, Barack Obama was the president. And every time there was a moment where the Obama administration could have intervened to help homeowners and working families, it was another opportunity for a big bailout for these home wreckers. And I think Obama was just maybe in a state of panic, maybe a little bit cozy to Wall Street. But I write about how a number of people came to the administration at various times asking them to do something like what President Roosevelt did during the Great Depression, where the government intervened in a crisis that was far worse than the 2008 housing bust, created a government-run bank that refinanced one out of every five mortgages in urban America, saved a million homes, and turned a profit for the taxpayers.
Could it have been possible to help both out, to help out people and the banks, or is it just one or the other?
Well, somebody needed to take a haircut, right? Mm-hmm. The question is, who was going to bear that cost? And during the Great Depression, President Roosevelt said the bank should bear the cost. The people should get the benefit. By contrast, during the 2008 housing bust, we forced the homeowners to assume all that risk, and we gave all the money to the banks. And because of that, we saw the homeownership rate decline. And now we have a wealth gap between the top 1/10 of 1% and the other 90% that is bigger than we've seen in 100 years.
Aaron, I you mentioned the house that you bought, San Francisco overlooking the Pacific Ocean at half of what it probably should have been worth because of the housing market crash. Do you ever feel conflicted about how you kind of became a winner in all this?
No, I don't feel conflicted at all. What concerns me is that there aren't more people like me who are winners. The whole motivation for writing this book was that I was able to use this crisis to get in. And I wondered, why weren't more other people able to do that? And what I learned was that a big reason for this is that big money Wall Street hedge fund guys were coming in, buying tons of homes with cash, and then, by the way, going to the banks and leveraging these homes in new types of mortgage-backed securities. So if you go to Sandy Jolly's family home in Thousand Oaks that we were talking about earlier, yeah, 1,500 square feet, you will see in the property record that there's not a $20,000 lien against it because the owner is remodeling the kitchen. There's a $900 million lien against it, a lien of almost $1 billion.
The book is titled Homewreckers: How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Venture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. And Aaron Glantz will be at KPCC's Crawford Family Forum Thursday at 7:30 to sign copies of his book and also chat with KPCC House reporter Matt Tinoco. The event is called Homewreckers: Decoding the American Dream. Aaron, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Emmy Martinez. It's a battle of old Hollywood versus new as more directors join in to slam on Marvel. Plus, Joaquin Phoenix's Joker is on track to become the biggest R-rated movie in history. Let's go on lot.
Hey, shut up! God, I'm with you.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She's also our showbiz guide every Wednesday. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, A.
All right. A few weeks back, legendary director Martin Scorsese said he did not consider Marvel films cinema. Now, a bunch of other directors, Ken Loach, Fernando Meirelles, and even Francis Ford Coppola have weighed in. What are they saying on this?
Well, some of them have taken it further than Scorsese, who said Marvel movies are more like an amusement park. Coppola said they're despicable. Ken Loach said Marvel movies are, quote, made as commodities like hamburgers. Meirelles had the most sort of measured response, just saying essentially Marvel movies are not for him. He described trying to watch one on a plane and losing interest, which, hey, who hasn't had that happen?
Yeah, he watched Deadpool. He liked Deadpool, but he didn't like Deadpool,
yes,
too. So, I could see that. All right, now, the Marvel crew isn't just sitting in silence taking in this criticism. Everyone from Taika Waititi, who directed a Thor Ragnarok, to Robert Downey Jr. has piped up about this. So what's the Marvel team saying?
Well, you know, Taika Waititi said, of course it's cinema. It's at the movies. John Favreau, who directed Iron Man 1 and 2, said, you know, look, these guys are legends. They've earned the right to express their opinions. Natalie Portman said there's room for all types of cinema. There's not just one way to make art.
Yeah, because that's the thing, Rebecca. I like both of them. I love superhero movies, and I love Francis Ford Coppola movies. I love Scorsese movies. So where does that leave someone like me? Am I just dumb in one area and not smart enough in the other? Where am I now?
You are a lucky consumer, A, because you do like superhero movies. I think part of what's happening here is that these directors are responding to a sense in the marketplace that is very hard to get theatrical releases for other kinds of movies that aren't superhero movies. So I don't think it's so much that they hate these movies, although they may. It's this sense that there is really only one type of movie that seems to be interesting Hollywood studios when it comes to giving it a big rollout.
And this story has caused a lot of tension, a lot of controversy. How much do you think it's just us media types driving this a little bit? Because I've seen so many comments from so many people all week long.
I mean, nothing gets clicks like riling up the fanboys and fangirls. So really, all of us in the media should just send Martin Scorsese a big thank you note.
Yeah. All right, let's move on now to some news about Joker.
What do we have here?
I did everything you said. I helped you.
You helped me by erasing my mind what faded memories I had. Oh. You left me in a black hole of rage and confusion.
That is not the current Joker. That's Jared Leto's as the famous villain in Suicide Squad. But let's talk about Leto for a second. He had some gripes with the new Joker out right now starring Joaquin Phoenix. What's the problem, Rebecca? What's his problem with that?
Well, the problem is he didn't want there to be another Joker movie that wasn't his, according to reporting by my colleague Kim Masters. Jared Leto had been trying to get his own Joker movie made at Warner Brothers based on his Suicide Squad character, who we were just hearing from, and he was upset that the studio was moving forward with a different movie.
Now, he actually tried to stop it from being made?
Yeah. He complained to his agents at CAA, who also happened to represent the director of the new Joker movie, Todd Phillips. By the way, Leto is no longer at CAA. He moved to WME. And he also had his music manager call the head of Warner's and try and stop the movie.
So it sounds like he was right to be worried, because Joker seems to be on track to hit a major milestone. Which milestone is it, Rebecca?
Yeah, the movie looks like it will end up being the highest grossing R-rated film of all time. Highest to date is Fernando Morales' favorite Deadpool, which earned $783 million worldwide. Joker is currently at about $740 million and continuing to play, so it should easily surpass that.
So it seems like all summer long and even into the spring, we've been talking about, when we talk about box office success, we talk Disney, just Disney, Disney, Disney. What does this mean for Warner Brothers? That's the studio behind Joker.
Well, it's very good news for Warner Brothers, which is happy to have the hit. It's also interesting because the studio has its sights set on Oscar season for this movie. So not only looking for a box office success, but potentially for some love in award season.
All right, let's close out on the ongoing saga of the streaming wars. Disney Plus has teamed up with Verizon to give them an edge. What edge did they get?
Well, Verizon customers will get a year of Disney Plus for free. The idea is to get more people on board and using the streaming service, and will be interesting to see if that works.
What kind, have we ever seen partnerships like this in the past?
T-Mobile has a deal where they pay for your Netflix account, which apparently worked well for T-Mobile, at least. The people who take advantage of the free Netflix are less likely to switch to another service.
What about for the streaming service itself?
Well, that's what's interesting. I mean, they're all kind of trying to build market share. Netflix has been using a number of different measures to do this. I'm not sure how well the T-Mobile subscription has helped as compared to all the other things they've done. But clearly, this is a strategy that others are going to employ. AT&T is going to launch HBO Max next year. I think it's safe to assume they'll have some kind of package offering there. And Apple is already offering people who buy a new Apple device a year of their service for free.
Rebecca, you write about Hollywood. You've been doing it a long time. Do you have all the streaming services at your fingertips? Does Hollywood Reporter pay for all that?
The Hollywood Reporter does not pay for all that. And I regularly look at my statements in all these $10 and $15 charges and wonder, what am I doing? Because it is getting expensive, especially like me, if you also pay for cable because you want sports and news and the other things that you get from that.
Yeah,
so it's an interesting question. Like, how much are consumers going to be willing to bear with all these new services launching?
I always feel like I'm missing out on something. Something streaming somewhere that I wish I could watch, but I just don't have time to watch it.
Yeah, and I, on the other hand, feel like I'm buried in potential content and I just want to go outside.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to chat about all things entertainment. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.